Poetry can often be lost amidst the worlds of Twitter and Facebook. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Salisbury is celebrating the city's Poetry Week with events that range from teaching middle school children about the medium to open mics and workshops for aspiring writers. Featured this week is award-winning poet Chris Salerno. He has written a new anthology entitled The Mangrave, which looks at the masculine experience. It'll be released later this year, and we have him on the phone this morning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let me just turn to the book itself and the title. What it inspired you to write this collection of poems?
Well, so The Mangrave is really, you know, about examining, you know, cultural manliness and, you know, what we've come to assemble for ourselves in our culture as men, you know, and I think The Mangrave, as, you know, as the title maybe suggests, which is kind of a pun or a play on the man cave, but, you know, the word grave there is really about both sort of burying the things that I'm maybe done with, and then also maybe, yeah, as grim as it sounds, digging things up that I have not fully embraced or engaged with.
Now, you talk, I think it's one of your poems, Sports No One Follows, and there are a number of them, but this one was about soccer, This idea about the Museum of Men's Loneliness for Men, and I think there's another line where you talk about bodies teamed up in dreams. Tell me a little bit about this need for the company of other men. I mean, I was particularly, by the way, I was struck by, I think it was the play Marty sort of plays on that same theme, as it were. Tell me a little bit about that need.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, manliness, you know, masculinity and what we've come to kind of create for ourselves in our culture as men is really a number of boundaries, you know, because of the way we assemble and because of what we don't allow ourselves to experience. I think we create a lot of barriers to, you know, well, for lack of a better word, intimacy, you know. I mean, I think, you know, we don't perhaps allow ourselves to share feelings or experiences or fears or, you know, a number of other emotions that we kind of learn early on to avoid, to hide, to keep from the outside world so as not to lose our place in the line of, you know, of men, you know, around us. And I think, you know, that's part of what I'm trying to explore in the book is, you know, just some of the, you know, some of the struggles that we have as men to, you know, at times perform our manliness, you know, perform our masculinity and you know, we're socialized pretty early on to avoid certain, you know, certain behaviors, certain expressions, and I think that we suffer from that.
As a matter of fact, another one, you talk about the idea, I don't know who invented violence, and it seemed to suggest, particularly through sports, that one of the ways that men relate to one another is violence, not necessarily violence in the sense of doing damage to a particular person, but certainly violence in terms of sports and competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I didn't grow up as a poet. You know, I didn't grow up with books. I didn't grow up with much of a sense of this kind of world that I'm in now. You know, I came to poetry through really, you know, overhearing it. You know, really, really sort of by accident. Yeah, I was a football player. I played 6 years of football, and I came from a family where books weren't really around or discussed or held, you know, and really, you know, sports culture was my culture, you know, and that was, you know, a place where I, you know, where I did find a lot of violence to, you know, to bring it back to your point. And yeah, so I think that violence can come out of this kind of deep allegiance to, you know, hiding one's feelings and being, less than forthcoming and less than expressive. And I wrote poems, you know, after after my football practice. Oh, and I hid those from people. You know, I didn't share that with anyone for a long time. And that interest I had, and because I felt ashamed of it. You know, and I felt like, you know, maybe I would be weaker for it, and then maybe I would be subject to violence. You know, and I think that there are all those elements are really at play there.
Well, as a matter of fact, talking about that, you talk about the F word, as it were, and I think it's in Crawling Back, this fear of being accused of being gay in some fashion, mm-hmm. which I assume, when you look at it, should be the antithesis, I guess, of this masculine view of men.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in our culture, we're boys and men in our culture are socialized to reject the feminine, you know, I mean, from a pretty early stage. And we as boys, you know, we do that to each other, you know, and I, especially in decades past, you know, before this kind of awakening and before this kind of, correction that we're living through now, where we're addressing, you know, some of these things much more explicitly. But, you know, in the 1980s, you know, it was brutal, and I was part of it. You know, I mean, I was certainly there, and you know, we didn't think twice about what we called each other and why and what it meant. We definitely performed our masculinity for each other in horrible ways, and we were unkind and just terrible in a lot of ways in our worst. You know, and. I think, you know, if you think about it, you know, from the time that we are boys, you know, men in America are socialized to believe that the opposite of being a man is being a little girl, you know, and that's a really problematic, equation, you know, if you carry it forward, because then it can yield a lot of terrible things, like, you know, misogyny and violence, against women. And you know, and so we have these root causes in our culture, in our gender, and in this book I try to explore them. You know, I'm trying to think a little bit about them and really my place in them too. You know,
one of the other things that you talk about is the concept of lust, obviously, with some history of fieldwork. But then you have another one, I think, is in Notes for Further Study, in which you say, I think of women I've loved who near the end make love for the endorphins. And it seems like there's a certain expression of resentment or separation in terms of relating to women, that that either men have been left behind, or that that there's this angst, as it were, about the opposite sex.
I think you're right. I mean, this how we as you know, heterosexual men deal with, you know, with relating to women when our whole lives we've really been doing the opposite. You know, we've you know, boy culture, you know, from an early age, kind of gets us rejecting the feminine, rejecting feelings, rejecting engaging on this level, and then here we are, and we're trying to then now have a relationship with a woman later, and we can find ourselves without the tools, without without the means, and then we end up relying on them to teach us how to feel our feelings, to teach us how to be vulnerable, to you know, to do these other things. And I think I've certainly struggled with that myself. You know, it's a long journey toward feeling comfortable in a relationship, you know, it takes a long time to be able to navigate one's own shame and one's own feelings and one's own history and the challenges of just, you know, being open, being emotionally available, being vulnerable, all these things that really are required for intimacy. And, you know, we as men are not, we're not advised to engage in these. And so we, you know, we have these periods in our life where we're kind of in a trial by fire kind of situation with this, because, you know, before a relationship, maybe, you know, our first serious relationship, we didn't have the tools, we didn't have the experience, and we haven't been talking to our friends about feelings, you know, and now we have someone who has sitting across from us, and how do we, you know, how do we catch up, you know? It's been interesting to examine.
Well, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, particularly a segment coming up about sports, and one of the interesting things about sports is that you have these guys who obviously are violent, or at least certainly highly competitive on the field, as it were, and that seems to spill over, or is part of then a relationship with, say, the woman they're with, and inevitably, for some men, this means violence against the very people that they're supposed to love and care about. There seems to be this dichotomy that sits there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how do we, on one hand, engage in this kind of, you know, misogynistic conversation and, you know, in the locker room with our friend, and then we go out and we love, you know, a woman on the other hand, and how do we bridge that, you know? I mean, that's kind of what the reckoning that I've sort of had to experience is, just, you know, I can't have both things, you know. I can't at once engage and allow this kind of thing at this kind of toxicity to be a part of, and then also try to have a real and honest relationship on the other hand. I think it goes back to that socialization, you know, that rejection of the feminine, you know, that idea that, you know, we can't be weak, we can't lose, we can't be wrong, we can't get lost, we can't ask for directions, you know. It's fascinating. You know, I read a study the other day that, you know, there was a study done, and men in the company of women ate 93% more pizza than they would eat in ordinary settings. And I thought, what is that? You know, that's so fascinating. Why would they do that? You know, what motivates us? And the point I get from that is that we don't even realize what we're doing. You know, we don't even realize how we've been socialized, or how we, you know, what is in us, you know, to perform or to align with, or, you know, to pledge allegiance to. We don't even realize how deep it's in us to act this way and that way according to the cultural kind of construct of gender.
The book itself and the poems seem to speak to a dark side of masculinity. I think there's one where you talk about, I'm other men, the son of their weight, a sadness hidden in laughter. This is a very dark view of masculinity.
Yeah, you know, it is. I'm kind of a student of, you know, this idea by the great Dr. Carl Jung, who talked about this idea of the shadow, this part of us that, you know, this part of our personalities where we tend to house what we don't want to face about ourselves, you know, what we don't want to accept about ourselves. And you know, there's this, what we call shadow work is sort of engaging with these parts, this dark aspects that we've maybe hidden. And so, I do in my poems try to invite that in, you know, because it's a part of our personalities that are not conscious to us, you know. We're not really, but we can try to, you know, invite some of that in, and when we do, it diffuses it, you know. And so that's a principle for me, you know, behind a lot of my poetry, is this idea of trying to invite that darkness in to maybe then, you know, allow it to kind of dissipate, you know. There is a bit of darkness there.
We've been speaking with Chris Salerno. He has written a new anthology entitled The Man Grave, which looks at the masculine experience. It'll be released later this year. We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Title IX was supposed to begin to alter the imbalance between men's and women's sports. But decades later, the disparity remains. We now turn to Julie DeCaro, a sports journalist and editor at Deadspin. She spent time not only writing about sports, but worked in the broadcast industry, including as a radio sports talk host. DeCaro has written a new book entitled Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America.
I just want to start off the gate. We've had March Madness, NCAA, and right off the top, we had this disparity about the weight rooms, the food buffets, and so on. As someone who does not follow sports on a general basis, when I saw that, I was just stunned. What was your reaction to that? What am I to think about that?
Yeah, my reaction was just sort of that the NCAA keeps finding new and interesting ways to tell women that they don't matter. You know, we saw the same thing with the WNBA bubble last summer where, you know, the guys had pretty much every amenity they could want at their beck and call, and the women were staying in kind of a ratty hotel. They had bed bugs traps under their beds. They were getting really subpar food. And, you know, the only way that we seem to be able to affect any kind of change is public shaming. I'm just sort of stunned that the NCAA didn't decide, you know, before we're doing this in two separate places, before, you know, we start, let's figure out what we have for the men, what we have for the women, and make sure things are comparable. But they just never seem to do that.
So your book is called Sidelined, in part in reference to the fact that a lot of the women, particularly covering sports, are stuck on the sidelines doing reporting there. Tell me a little bit about that experience that you had yourself in terms of watching particularly women who come up through the ranks, who had to fight some of this good fight, and how they still seem to get sidelined.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is a glass ceiling, particularly in the broadcast booth. So it's easy for women, not easy, but, you know, sideline work is something that is an acceptable place for women to be in the industry, right? You're regurgitating facts. You're soliciting opinions from men and not necessarily giving your own. It's an incredibly demanding job. And, you know, as someone who looks up to both Laura Oakman and Andrea Kramer and Pam Oliver, I know that this is a really difficult job that they do incredibly well. It just shouldn't be the only job that women can have in sports media. So, you know, the play-by-play booth especially has been difficult for us to break into. You know, if you look at sports talk radio, I think you see hardly any women. And the ones you do see have shows late at night or, you know, like overnights. There aren't a lot of prominent women broadcasting during the day, during marquee slots. And so, you know, it's frustrating to watch those jobs just go over and over and over to people who look the same, knowing that there are a lot of women out there that could do it just as well.
You talk a little bit about the fact that you at times found yourself hesitant to break in to give your own opinion. What is that like to have that hesitation?
Boy, for someone that is opinionated as I am, it is very tough. You wind up self-censoring a lot, meaning that you have thoughts on something and maybe a position that is needed. For example, when we're talking about sexual harassment, and then you have a panel of four guys sitting there talking about sexual harassment, women's voices are needed in those conversations. At the same time, you know that if you wade into this, you're going to get a ton of blowback. If you're on the air, you know, it's going to come in via the phones and the text line. If you're on social media, it's going to come in via Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And there's a lot of times that women just decide, you know what, this isn't worth it. I really have something to say, but I just don't have the energy to deal with the blowback that I'm going to get. So instead you say nothing. And in that way, we leave a lot of important voices out of the conversation.
You describe, as a matter of fact, in a video, More Than Mean, in which you have men reading some of the comments that you got, that Spain got. Tell me a little bit about that decision to try to do that and the reaction particularly of the men as they read these.
Yeah, so I had written an article for Sports Illustrated about the vitriol that women deal with online. And because of that article, the guys from Just Not Sports reached out to me, and they all work in commercial and PR and stuff, so they really know what they're doing when it comes to making public service announcements. And they said, you know, we have this idea, we're going to do a Jimmy Kimmel kind of mean tweets thing, but the tweets are going to get progressively darker, and eventually we're going to show people what you guys deal with. And that day in particular, I had been so abused online, I was like willing to do anything.
Let's play a portion of that, at least without the profanity, to give people a sense about what it is that you're receiving online.
Hopefully this skank Julie DeCaro is Bill Cosby's next victim. That would be classic.
I don't know what to say to that.
I don't. I don't think I can even say that.
I hope your boyfriend beats you. I'm sorry.
Why bring up your own rape in this story? Is it your way of firing back at critics who said you can't get any?
That's something, huh?
I'm sorry.
Okay. So I have to read all of them, right? Because, I mean, I don't...
Read them, I guess.
I hope you get raped again.
Oh.
Julie.
You know, the video came out. We thought maybe some people in the industry will watch it and maybe they'll comment on it. And the day that it came out, I, took a nap and woke up and had like 700 notifications on my phone because the video had gone out and it just took over everything. It's interesting because as Sarah and I talked about the video, we noticed that people were much more upset with the men's reactions to reading it than they were to our reactions. So the guys are seeing this stuff for the first time. They are visibly upset. They're shaken. They're apologizing to us. And that is what really seemed to strike a chord with people. They didn't care so much that people were saying it to Sarah and I. They cared that men were upset at reading this. And I always wonder if we hadn't had men read it, if it had just been Sarah and I reading them, if we would have gotten the same reaction.
I want to turn to now sexual assault in sports. We've seen a number of cases. I mean, it's just numerous. Here on the Eastern Shore, we've watched the Baltimore Ravens with Ray Rice, with vivid video of him slamming his girlfriend, as it were. Tell me a little bit about how the leagues deal with this and the fact that they don't seem to be coming around, or if they do come around, it seems to be very hesitant.
Yeah, it is very hesitant. Nobody in sports wants you to watch sports and feel bad. Everybody wants you to feel good when you're watching sports, and that's how they make their money. So, we've got leagues that do a lot of lip service to things like domestic violence and sexual assault, but don't do much beyond that. So they may have an investigation, a guy might get suspended for a couple games, and then that's it. I think that Major League Baseball probably does a better job than anyone else when it comes to this, because they actually have the player evaluated by a professional, and that professional tells them what sort of counseling they need. Now, the counseling that MLB is able to dole out doesn't go nearly far enough, especially if you're talking about domestic violence. You've got guys who need to be in counseling for years and years and years, and there's no way that Major League Baseball can make them do that. But at least Major League Baseball is making the effort, whereas like in the NHL and the NFL, it's purely punitive. And, that harms both the victim and the abuser. So we've got a long way to go, I think.
One of the things that struck me is there really any counseling for this? I mean, if people tend to be this way to begin with, to be violent, particularly towards women, but perhaps others as well. I mean, we can talk about counseling all we want, but does it really work?
Yeah, there's something called batter intervention counseling that has been has had success in the domestic violence community. And it involves a lot of group therapy. So abusers are, historically and infamously charming, nice guys. No one can ever think that they would do something like that. And then you see, like you saw in the Ray Rice video. And unfortunately, we don't have videos in most cases. Unfortunately, it's sort of the woman's word against the guy's word. But, there is counseling where it's a group of men who abuse women, and they hold each other accountable because they can call each other out on their BS. So, in that regard, like, we do have some programs that can work for some people. Unfortunately, it takes years and, 30 days, suspension for MLB, or them even making someone do counseling for 6 months just isn't nearly enough.
I want to turn to a difficult case, which was Kobe Bryant. And I remember when he was killed, we, of course, did some interviews with some folks. But we also included, of course, the allegation of a sexual assault. Tell me a little bit about how you reacted to that and how you felt in terms of trying to address both. Obviously, he did a lot for women's sports. But on the other hand, he had this incident, which he didn't seem to really apologize for.
Yeah, it was the incident. You know, he was charged with sexual assault in Colorado. The case wound up being dropped because of an agreement between him and the woman who was accusing him. It wasn't he wasn't found not guilty like a lot of people think. And I think that because this happened before the advent of social media, that a lot of people have a lot of misinformation about this. Like, you know, young kids today will say, "Oh, well, Kobe was found innocent, and it was proven that she was a liar." And I'm like, that is not what happened. So, you know, when I was sitting at the library actually working on the Kobe Bryant chapter, when I got the news that, you know, his plane, his helicopter had crashed and that he was killed along with his daughter. And I really was like, should I even keep writing this chapter? Should I even include it at all? Obviously, he did mean a lot to a lot of people, and he did a lot of good. But I don't think you redeem yourself for a sexual assault, which he essentially admitted to in a statement, by, you know, cheering on the WNBA. Like, I thought there needed to be more, and a lot of women and a lot of sexual assault victims, men included, felt like there needed to be more. And a lot of us were uncomfortable with sort of the deification that happened afterwards, because it did leave out a really important chapter. And, you know, not only a chapter that was important in the life of him and his victim, but also, you know, it's sort of his attorney sort of created a playbook for how you discredit a woman who's accusing a rich and famous person of sexual assault. So I felt like it deserved to be part of the conversation. And it was a difficult decision because I knew people weren't going to like it. I knew I was going to get people screaming at me that I'm trying to slander a dead person. But, you know, the sexual assault survivor myself, I felt like there was a conversation that needed to be had.
I finally want to turn to the disparity, particularly in terms of income. You point to, for instance, disparity of pay in soccer, WNBA versus the NBA, for example. And has the Title IX, the federal funding, improved the status of women in terms of being able to be athletes?
Well, Title IX is interesting. I mean, I am a daughter of Title IX. I was born in the 70s. I grew up playing sports my entire life. Sports are absolutely as big a part of my life as they are any of my brothers or my dad or, you know, any guy that I know. So in that sense, Title IX was enormous. And I got to travel to Pakistan a couple years ago and saw what a world looks like without Title IX, where, you know, you don't have to have women's sports. And in a lot of places, they just don't because, you know, who's going to make them? So, you know, in that sense, I think that, yeah, it's hugely important. But, you know, going back to what we saw in the NCAA tournament, the first couple of games where we saw, you know, women having really inferior accommodations, an inferior weight room, inferior food. They didn't even have enough photographers to put images of the women into photo serves for those of us that cover them to use in articles. So, you know, in some ways, Title IX is great. In other ways, Title IX is easy for schools to get around, and, you know, we still have a long way to go.
Are you optimistic that things are going to get seriously better, or do you think this is a long haul kind of effort?
Well, I think it's a long haul, given that we're 40 years since a woman went into the locker rooms, you know, and sued to go into the locker rooms. It feels like we should be a lot further along. At the same time, I see things like the UConn-Baylor game the other night, where everyone was watching this women's game on my Twitter timeline and weighing in on it. You see the huge boost that the NWA got last summer in viewership. You see the women's national soccer team, where, you know, multiple women on that team are household names. So, you know, I do have hope. We just seem to sort of make progress in fits and starts. And it would be great to see a long period of sustained upward progress as opposed to getting it in these little spurts.
We appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning. It's Julie DeCaro, sports journalist and editor at Deadspin. Her new book is entitled Sidelined: Sports, Culture, and Being a Woman in America. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.